Our first speaker today is Dr. Thomas Corbett. Tom began his career as a research analyst in the Department of Health and Social Services. He is presently the Associate Director for the Institute for Research on Poverty, and he's an Assistant Professor in the Department of Social Work. Last year, he was on leave from the university, serving as a Senior Policy Analyst in the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Planning and Evaluation in the United States Department of Health and Human Services, and he worked on welfare reform issues there. He has done extensive work on poverty and other social policy issues at all levels of government, the local, state, and national. His scholarly work has focused primarily on the evolution of welfare and implications for reform. I tried to bring along a visual today to represent the talk that each of these speakers is going to give. And here's Tom. Now, for those of you in the back who are a little nearsighted, yes, this is an onion. And for those of you who don't know Tom, you may think this onion symbolizes his talk because he's going to bore you to tears. No, nothing could be further from the truth. Tom eloquently uses this onion analogy to illustrate the diversity of the welfare population. And that's one of our main themes today, the diversity of the welfare population. So Tom, let me introduce you. His topic today is Child Poverty and Welfare Dependency, an Enduring Dilemma.
Pleasure to be here, I think. I was trying to remember when I first used this onion analogy, and I think it was in the late 1980s, and I was asked to give a talk in the state of Vermont, a very similar audience. And I was asked to at the last minute, and I just sort of came up with this particular metaphor for the task of doing welfare reform. I haven't been able to shake it since. I gave a couple of talks earlier this fall. After I got back from Washington, and people came up afterwards and said, "Oh, nice talk, but why didn't you talk more about the onion?" So I'll never be able to shake this. Anyways, Karen said, I spent last year in Washington, and I know some of you have heard this, so let me tell you about my experience in Washington. Since I've come back, I've had this recurring dream. Some of you may recall that in the old days, judges would, when they were confronted with juvenile offenders, would give them a choice. You can either go to jail or you can go into the military. I've had this dream ever since I've come back that I'm before a judge, and he says, you can go to jail or you can spend a year in Washington working on welfare reform. And I fall to my knees and say, jail, please. But actually, it was a good experience, and the best part of the experience was meeting and I've met someone before that, but working more closely with people like Chris and Rebecca, who are just wonderful people, very smart. And Rebecca is stunned when I'm saying something nice about her. Why are we still talking about welfare reform? I've characterized it in several ways, and my favorite characterization is that welfare reform is a sucking swamp. Everyone wants to do it, but it's very hard to do well. And I'm really struck by the fact that the rhetoric today about the poor and about welfare is almost the same as it was 100 years ago, before we had federal welfare, when it was a local responsibility, and states and local governments, in fact, many of them, tried to abolish welfare, and quite unsuccessfully. And almost since we had a federal role in welfare, since the Social Security Act, almost every president has tried to reform it. Franklin Roosevelt said, we want to quit this business of relief. Dole out relief is to administer a narcotic. John Kennedy had the first full presidential press conference devoted to welfare reform. Lyndon Johnson, on his first day in office, launched or set in motion the Great Society, which was to be a hand up, not a handout. Richard Nixon, in his memoirs, talked about welfare reform being his biggest priority, domestic priority. Jimmy Carter, very early in his presidency, launched a welfare reform effort. Of course, we had Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, who promised to end welfare as we know it. But we still have welfare, and we still have essentially the same kind of system in many respects that we had that was created as part of the Social Security Act. Now, there are a lot of low-income programs, but when we talk about welfare, most people really think about AFDC, Aid to Families with Dependent Children. And there are probably about 75 low-income programs that one can focus upon. But that's the one that people are really, generally, that's the one that generates the most emotion. And if you look at the public opinion polls, upwards to 90% of people say they want to change that system. But probably less than 10% really said they want to eliminate it altogether. So people are struggling looking for change, but they're looking for sensitive change. What's driving the more recent, I think, call for reform is that, and I think there are some likely suspects, is it cost? Well, looking at the national scene, in fact, we spent about the same in real dollars and what we're spending in 1992 that we're spending back in 1972, about $24 to $25 billion. When you just take the federal share of AFDC costs, it comes to less than 1% of the federal budget. If you take AFDC and food stamps and welfare for the aged, blind, and disabled, and you look at similar programs back in 1960, you add them up and it was 3.3% of federal expenditures. In 1993, it had risen only to 4.4% of federal expenditures. It's not a big item, even at the state level. The cost, I don't think, is the big thing. What about caseload? Is it because more people are getting welfare? Well, if the numbers hold up in fiscal year 1994, we'll find that the caseload will probably nationally be over 5 million cases, well over 14 million people. That is up. That might be a cause for concern. Back in 1960, about 4% of kids got welfare. Now it's up to about 14%. And back in 1960, about 16% of all poor kids got welfare. Now it's over 60%. But in fact, that figure is less than in 1973, when 80% of poor kids were getting AFDC. So the numbers are up, but actually fewer poor children are getting assistance now than a couple of decades ago. I think the real issue, the thing that really keys people, and probably what has brought you into this room, is the perception that that welfare causes problems in personal behavior and in community functioning, whether real or imagined. Now let me define what welfare is to launch into that a little bit. My definition of welfare is not the FDC or food stamps or Medicaid, but that a welfare program, or the concept of welfare program, is one in which you can get the money without working, but if you do go to work, you make your life a living hell. Now, are we doing that because we're evil people? No, I think that we've evolved a welfare system that is flawed for some very good reason. If I were to say I want to create a program, I want to make it target efficient, that is, I really want to focus the benefits on the truly poor, that I want to make it flexible, I want to make it accountable, and I want to make it efficient, you say, that's a great program. Now let me run through what we've done with welfare in those areas. Target efficiency. We target the benefits on the income poor. What does that mean? Well, as you go to work and start to earn money, the benefits fall. That, in effect, becomes a tax rate. That, in effect, for most welfare recipients, becomes, after a period of time, a 100% marginal tax rate. For every dollar they earn, they lose a dollar of benefits. We would never impose that kind of tax rate on any other segment of society, at least not without a revolution. We target benefits on the asset poor. So you need to start to earn some money, to send your kids to educate your kids better, start a business, whatever, to improve yourself, to be a little entrepreneurial, we kick you off the rolls. If you own a vehicle, that will get you to work and back, that's reliable, it's probably worth too much, we kick you off. We also target benefits on single parents. Two parents can get benefits, but it's easier if you're a single parent. That creates incentive features that we don't like. But it seems to make sense to target those on most in need. And we also target a lot of the benefits associated with welfare, child care and education training, on recipients. That makes sense. Those are the people that we want to get off of welfare. But if you target on recipients, you create entry effects sometimes. If you have good service programs, people will come on welfare to get your good services. And if you target on recipients, you forget the fact that a lot of people leave welfare. 70% will leave within 2 years of coming on. but most of them come back. And if we only concern ourselves with the people who, while they're on welfare, we miss a big part of the problem, which is getting sustained exits from the rolls. Let me quickly go through the others. Flexibility. Let's talk about block grants. We've always had some flexibility in AFDC. States can set their own benefit level. And I think if we look at the witness what's happened over the last 20, 25 years, that flexibility has led to interstate competition, the famous welfare magnet problem. So that all states, in a sense, have allowed their benefit guarantees to fall. And in fact, since 1970, the typical state of the benefit has fallen by almost half. Accountability. We want programs that are accountable. What do we measure in welfare? We measure error rates, fraud, abuse. That means that what the workers are primarily concerned about is not how do we help this person become self-sufficient, but making sure all the documentation is in the file. Where's your birth certificate? Where's this? Where's that? No one says, how can I help you? We have set up a system, generally speaking, where the role of the worker is to be a cop. And efficiency. Everyone wants efficiency. Low overhead. But again, that has meant, in a sense, that we focus on getting the checks out in a very efficient manner and to the exclusion of doing some other things to change and improve people's lives. Okay, so it's easy, as Karen said, it's easy to identify the flaws, the problems. They've been known for years and years. How do we start dealing with all this? Well, quite obviously, it's a thicket. It's a problem. And it's a problem in part because we can't agree on goals or the theories or the technologies. I won't go through all that. I don't think I have time. But let me just say, in terms of goals, is it only to reduce caseloads and costs? Are we trying to change also human behavior, which might lead to increased costs? Are we concerned about child poverty, which might also be a legitimate goal? In terms of theories, there are a bunch of them, but some of them fall in what I call the institutional sphere and others in the individual sphere. When we talk about institutional theories about why people are poor and on welfare, generally talking about problems with jobs. There aren't enough of them, they're not in the right place, they don't pay enough, our educational system is failing, and so forth. When we talk about individual failings, we're generally talking about lack of motivation, maybe low human capital, and things of that nature. And we can't agree on which one is correct or what the proper mix of the two are. And technologies, we have a lot of ideas. I mean, I argue all the time that I've seen very little that's new in welfare reform. And if you've been in this area long enough, it seems like you've seen it all. And in the appendix to the briefing report, I list a whole number of them that we've tried over the last 30 years. What I find is that it's really problematic is when we get to the notion of what's the debate, what's the question, what we're really trying to address. And typically, unfortunately, I think we talk only about dependency, or we talk about improper behaviors, like improper fertility decisions. If that is all we're concerned about, if we're only concerned about dependency, my classic line is, make me welfare czar, and I'll end dependency in a week. And I won't even break into a sweat. I would just end welfare. No problem. We kind of laugh at that. Yeah?
Can you talk closer into the mic?
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's hard to hear.
Is it? Okay. That if... Oh, yeah. I can hear myself now. Thank you. If it was only dependency, as I said, make me czar, I'll end welfare dependency in a week by ending welfare. I kind of laugh at that, but as I mentioned before, in a way we've been doing it, at least in terms of cash welfare transfers, we've allowed the typical guarantees to fall by almost half in the last 25 years. But it's trickier than that, because we're also concerned at least about one other thing, at least, and that is child poverty and family poverty. And we've seen over the kind of the same period of time, particularly since the late 1970s, an increase in child poverty. In 1993, it was over 15 million children were poor. Back in 1978, it was less than 10 million. And there are other statistics in the briefing book that compare child poverty rates in the United States with other countries and so forth. So what makes welfare reform a wicked problem is that we're trying to do more than one thing. And the real trick is to reduce dependency and other things that we don't like about behavior and poverty at the same time. Now, how do we get 10 minutes? Okay. 12 minutes, all right. Let me just quickly say, I just want to make one point about the history. I won't go into this. Now that I have 2 more minutes, I can squeeze this in. I think we tend to think that we've always known we've had this, the current welfare system forever and ever. And even within the federal, I think, welfare role, we've had tremendous changes in the last, I mean, it's essentially the same program in many ways, but we've had tremendous changes over the last 60 years. And in many ways, each generation discovers the scandal. The last generation's reform becomes a scandal for this current cohort of reform effort. Way back, and even before federal welfare, when states had what were called mothers' pensions programs, where they give money to mothers who didn't have a spouse, the purpose of that was to allow the mother to really do a good job in their child-rearing role. And it was a reaction to the fact that children very often were taken out of the home, put in orphanages, if the family was poor, or sent off, if talking about East Coast poor children, sent off to farms in Minnesota and others on Wisconsin, places like this. So the emergence, in a sense, of state and then later federal welfare payments to these mothers was, in a sense, a reaction to a theme that you now hear a lot about. Why don't we build orphanages? And why don't we take these poor kids out of these terrible homes? The original purpose of welfare was, in a sense, to help mothers, keep them out of the federal role, keep them out of the labor market, and help them in their child-rearing capacity. It's changed. By the 1950s, I think it took, welfare took a lot of moral overtone. We had fit home criteria. We were judging people in a lot of different ways. 1960s was heavily imbued with the rehabilitation theme. And if you look at many of the reforms that we've talked about, Learn Fair and many of the others, you would have found them all in the 1950s and 1960s. In a sense, we were returning to the welfare system we once had. The big change in welfare, the concept that we're now, in a sense, rebelling against, really emerged in the late 1960s and early 70s. And in part, it was an attempt to move towards a minimalist government. It was to get social workers out of the business of dealing with the poor, legal defense lawyers, all the community action stuff. And it was really just said, let's give the poor a little bit of money and let that be the end of it. In fact, John Ehrlichman, who was Nixon's advisor, and when they were developing the family assistance plan, the first principle he laid out in instructions to the people who were going to be developing the plan was to make sure we get all the social workers out of the business of dealing with the poor. And the way that we're going to do that was to go to a negative income tax, a guaranteed income floor. So that, which was a very conservative and almost Republican concept 20 years ago, now has become something that we're rebelling against. I like to point that out to show how difficult it is to address these issues. Okay. The onion. What does it mean? Essentially, it's a very simple concept. If you take all the poor and the dependent poor, people on welfare, you can array them in kind of a queue in terms of human capital, in terms of their ability to function, in terms of their motivation, and so forth. They're not all alike, and we know that they're not all alike because we have some sense of the attributes of people on welfare, but also we see very different careers. We see a lot of people who pass through very quickly. We see a lot of people, probably even a larger proportion, who evidence episodic careers of welfare. They get off, they come back, and so forth. In fact, within about 5 years of new entrants, more than 85% will leave the role. Unfortunately, about 70% of those will return within the next 5 years. And many will be on and off. They use welfare almost as an unemployment insurance program. And there are those who don't leave. They're in the inner core. And they're there because of very, because they may be disabled, or if they're not on a disability program, or they may have very low earnings capacity, or in fact, they are part of the culture of poverty. If you buy that these people are rating this queue, and you sort of circle the queue, you have layers. And there are different reforms for different layers of the union. There are some things that people need to, frankly, simply make work pay, make work a rational decision. These people are getting off, coming on, getting off again. In part, what they may need is a better array or set of options. That is, they should be able to, raise their family above the poverty threshold. If they're working full-time, full-year, playing by the rules, they should not lose access to health insurance for their children, affordable child care, and so forth. And there are a lot of ways in which you can make work pay. If work is a rational option, will all the poor disappear? Will all the people on welfare disappear? I don't think so. Because there are people on the rolls who, in fact, have very low earnings capacity. They can't compete in the labor market. They need rehabilitation. So if the first theme is rationality, rational options, the next theme is rehabilitation. Training, education, basic skills, and so forth are required. We have some of that, obviously, in the jobs program, but it's a real question of whether or not we are investing enough. If you have a good rehabilitation programs, would that end welfare? Would that move people off the rolls and become self-sufficient? Probably not. Because some people do have serious problems that prohibit them from even getting into rehabilitation programs. Chemical abuse, clinical depression, legal problems, spousal problems, on and on and on. So that perhaps we need to remediate some of these problems, and perhaps in some cases get into reciprocal obligations with some of these people. That is, in fact, make benefits conditional so that there is a consequence of bad behavior. If you have that, will that end the welfare problem? Probably not, because there are some people on the rolls who probably are so lacking in ability and in human capital and earnings capacity that, in fact, they belong in a disability program. Or, in fact, it's cheaper to simply give them a check. The basic point of this is that if we assume that all welfare recipients are alike, this is a very, no matter how sophisticated we get, no matter how much information we have, it is very easy, and we all do it, to fall into the problem of coming up with a single image of welfare recipients to represent the whole welfare population. For the liberals, it's often, the struggling mother who doesn't have access to good opportunity and jobs and child care and so forth. For the conservatives, it's very often, the inner city minority person who lacks simply the will to do what's right and play by the rules. And in fact, I would say to the liberals and conservatives, you're both right and you're both wrong. Both images capture a part of the truth. And then we sort of have to go beyond these sort of simple stereotypes and begin to recognize the complexity of the undertaking that we are embarking on. I don't know if Representative Riley's not here, but he was quoted at one point saying, and which I agree with totally, that giving people a little bit of money is the cheapest way of dealing with the poor, but it's not necessarily the most effective way. Those aren't exactly his words, but that's what he was trying to convey. And I agree, the greatest virtue of AFDC, which is where I started, and welfare in general, is that it is cheap. If you really begin to say, we're not in the business of simply providing a little bit of money to these families, so we're going to move from the check issuance system and approach to a people-changing approach, then the task is much more difficult. And that's why the conservatives argued for a check-issuing approach 20 years ago. And I think that the rest of the speakers are really going to talk more fully about what it's going to take, I think, to get into the core of the onion, what kind of 2- and 3-generational service intervention programs are we really going to have to start thinking about and investing in to make a dent there. Let me just end on a funny pessimistic note. That was the optimism for me. I do kind of worry about where the macro economy is going. I avoided talking about all the problems with the economy, the growing wage inequality, the growing income inequality, the problems with earning a family wage, all the contextual problems that we have to talk about if we're really serious about welfare reform. Much of this discussion focuses on the individual, and I think that misses a large part of the problem. But you only gave me 25 minutes. The other part is that there, when I look into the future, when you look at where we're spending our money and what's going to happen with entitlements over the next 2-3 decades, there will be an explosion of entitlement spending unless there are changes made. And most entitlements go to the middle class and to the elderly, who are actually, in general, quite well off. If you look at the chart in the book, we made great progress in reducing poverty among the elderly. And by 1993, in fact, the point estimate for them is lower than the point estimate poverty rate for prime age adults. As we try to balance the budget and do these other things, I'm very much afraid that spending on children, when we look at federal expenditures now, for every $1 we spend on children, we spend about $11 on the elderly. And I know I'm getting into an intergenerational war here, but let me just say this anyway. I'm afraid that spending on children is going to decline even further. You know, we block grant a lot of these programs, even back to the states, with the pressures you're facing, that over time we'll spend even less. And I think that would be very unfortunate.
Very much, Tom. Very interesting. And we're going to take 5 minutes of questions for Tom. Yes?
The president last night was pushing for raising the minimum wage. Bob, you think he's done and how does he feel about the welfare of arguments on both sides of that?
I'm going to repeat the question because we're doing an audio tape. So the question was, the president talked about raising the minimum wage last night. And Tom, can you comment on both sides of what effect that might have on the welfare reform debate? Right.
On the one hand, it's really addressing one of the big problems. If you look at the proportion of, let's say, of young males or females who are what we call low earners, that is, they're working full year, full time, they can't earn enough to raise their family above the poverty threshold. You'll have seen over time that that proportion fell dramatically in the 1950s and 1960s, and beginning in the early 1970s, when our economy changed, the structure of our economy changed, it began to go up. That means that it's much harder to earn in the current economy enough, particularly if you're a young earner, to get your family out of poverty or to escape welfare. We expanded the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a refundable credit for low-wage earners, to the point where that helps. But still, even with that, coupled with the minimum wage, a single-earning family head probably can't earn enough to get a family above the poverty threshold. The minimum wage, if it were raised, would help families accomplish that. By historical standards, the federal minimum wage, which is $4.25 an hour, is, I think, in the late 1960s, the equivalent, after adjusting for inflation, value would have been over $6 an hour. So it's really fallen in real terms. The problem with the minimum wage are two. One, it's not target efficient, which is what I talked about earlier in a very negative sense. That is, a lot of minimum wage earners are teenagers and so on and so forth. And of course, which I think is a problem with it, the second allegation is that it costs jobs. I'm actually less persuaded by that, having looked at some of the evidence. I think there's an initial adjustment period in which the employers sort of adjust to the new reality, but I'm not persuaded it really costs a lot of jobs. So if you're on balance, I'm kind of in favor of it.
Another question for Tom.
Yeah.
What do you think the result has been of some of the issued benefit demonstration projects?
The issued? Yeah. Ken Fullen's asking about the assured benefit child support concept. The assured benefit, in 25 words or less, is a publicly guaranteed child support payment to parents where the absent parent isn't paying enough, in effect. What makes it a make-work pay or make-work fractional strategy is that that benefit is not reduced or taxed like AFDC benefits are taxed. So that it can become an income floor upon which a custodial parent can add their earnings and have a better shot of escaping poverty and getting and leaving welfare. It is only being tried. A lot of people have endorsed it. It was actually conceived here in Wisconsin, and we almost had a couple of pilots in the late 1980s on that initiative. It's only being tried in New York State right now in a kind of not a pure version of it. And the results, I think, have been fairly positive in terms of improving the economic well-being of children, welfare access, and so forth. But it hasn't been tried in pure form. So we don't know. Yes?
We hear a lot of comments about the failure of the welfare system. Are there successes?
Well, we hear a lot of problems about the failure of the welfare system, of their successes. At one point, I think welfare, in fact, probably provided enough support to raise families out of poverty. As we've allowed the welfare system to deteriorate, in a lot of the guarantees, the amount of money we give to people who have no other income, we've seen child poverty increase. Now, there may be other reasons for that. Increase, but it does provide some measure of economic support to families who otherwise would be in extreme distress. But I think it's arguable that it doesn't provide that support in a way that really enables families to reach some decent level of economic security or independence. So I think that the trick is not necessarily to defend welfare, but to really think very much more creatively about what we're going to put in its place. If we go to simple kind of nostrums, like let's just end it, or let's just impose a very sort of arbitrary time limit, that has, it's understandable and it has political appeal. But very frankly, it could really result in either a lot of social problems that we will not want to witness in this country, or shifts in cost to other programs. If kids who are on welfare now end up in substitute care or group homes or whatever, you're talking about costs that could increase to $36,000 a year. Well, that doesn't take much of a shift to break the bank. So in a way, yeah, it's cheap, and it does provide some measures of economic security, but I think the real challenge is creatively about what we're going to do to make kids and families better and more fully functioning for the future.